of months earlier, in February 1998, UBL had issued a public fatwa declaring war on the West. The trend seemed clear. AQ would pose an increasing threat to the United States and our interests. Having participated in the promotion panel and gained a better sense of our collective efforts, I appreciated the expansiveness and complexity of the counterterrorism mission. I figured it was bound to grow. More important, so did Director George Tenet, who had issued his own declaration of war against AQ. At this point, however, I had no inkling that counterterrorism would soon dominate our national security agenda. I returned to our overseas post, wrapped up the tour, and on the day of our departure for home, learned about the attacks on our embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. It was 7 August 1998. Cindy, our children, and I were in our driveway, overlooking our yard, waiting for the van to take us to the airport. We had spent so much time in these expansive, lush gardens. The boys and their Labrador dogs loved the trees, bushes, rocks, and hiding places. The weather was near perfect, as usual. We already knew that we would miss this place, miss Africa. My wife and I had met on an African beach. We had started raising our family, 3 boys, in 3 different African countries. They had learned to swim, backpack, shoot, and compete in local sports like rugby. They had studied Swahili, French, and local tribal languages. They did not want to leave. The phone in the house rang, and I walked back inside, figuring it was somebody with an administrative matter related to our departure. There was usually at least 1 major glitch in any transfer. "Yeah," I answered, preparing to be perturbed. It was the station. "Our embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam have been hit. Car bombs. Bad. Real bad." "Any word on casualties? Any direction from HQS?" I wondered if I should stay or divert to either city to provide support. I knew both cities well. We had friends, American and foreign nationals, working in both these embassies. I tried to imagine the carnage. I wondered who among our friends had died. "No, nothing. It just happened." "Okay. I will go with the family to Europe, where we transit, and I will call from there." I walked back to the driveway where the van now waited. I told the family. They asked questions. How many died? Our friends? Would there be other attacks? Why? Who was responsible? On the way to the airport, I thought about possible perpetrators. Hezbollah had killed more U.S. citizens than any other terrorist group. But AQ had been operating in East Africa, particularly Somalia, since the early 1990s. The CIA had been tracking and disrupting AQ plots around the world, including Africa. Had AQ regrouped and executed this? From Amsterdam, I called HQS and recommended that my family continue to the United States and I reverse course for Nairobi. HQS denied my reflexive proposal and instructed me to continue home and prepare for my FBI assignment. The FBI would be deploying teams to the crime scenes. It would be the largest overseas criminal investigation and largest overseas deployment of FBI agents ever. Very few of them had ever been to Kenya or Tanzania, or Africa for that matter. I was now embarked on a counterterrorism mission that would last 4 hard, deadly years. Chapter 7. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Just the minute the FBI begins making recommendations on what should be done with its information, it becomes a Gestapo. J. Edgar Hoover. I gleaned the horrific details of the attacks from the press accounts and from my phone calls to CIA HQS. It was soon clear that AQ was responsible. On the morning of 7 August 1998, AQ operatives driving trucks laden with explosives attempted to breach the security barriers at our embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi. In Nairobi, a Kenyan guard refused, at gunpoint, to to lower the metal barrier that blocked the entrance to the basement parking area, the bomber's objective. This guard's heroic act prevented even greater casualties. The driver, halted at the guard post in the back of the building, detonated the bomb. The back side of the structure was ripped open, but the building stood. The suicide bomber killed more than 200 people and wounded close to 4,000. Friends and colleagues were among the casualties. An embassy officer and friend, Steve Nolan, was among those who responded courageously. Although injured himself, he hauled the wounded out of the shattered embassy and quickly helped re-establish a functioning diplomatic presence. Nolan would rise through the State Department ranks and be appointed an ambassador. He would serve in Africa, a place he loves, for many more years. At almost the same time, a suicide bomber drove his vehicle to the entrance of the embassy in Dar es Salaam, but was blocked by a brave Tanzanian guard manning a barricade. Again, the suicide bomber failed to penetrate the compound. The huge blast killed 11 and wounded 85. An embassy official whom I had known for many years was sitting in his heavy, plastic, high-backed swivel chair in his office when the bomb detonated. The explosion blew in the concrete wall at his back, propelling his chair and him over the top of his desk. Miraculously, he was uninjured. The wall and his chair absorbed the concussion and shrapnel. He and other embassy officials rallied. They secured the classified material, accounted for all their people, activated their networks, and restored full communications in nearby temporary sites. Of all the dead in these two bombings, 12 were Americans. The CIA quickly dispatched teams to collect intelligence and to support the incoming FBI investigators. CTC Chief Jeff O'Connell selected CIA Operations Officer Gary Burnson for Dar es Salaam and an FBI agent on loan to CTC for Nairobi as the team leaders. Jeff understood that leadership was important, and he picked two good ones. They helped pave the way for the FBI agents, who arrived by the dozen. The East Africa bombings dominated my first few months at the FBI, where I was assigned as the deputy chief in the International Terrorism Operations Section, ITOS, responsible for FBI counterterrorism efforts against international groups both inside and outside the United States. There was a separate section that dealt with domestic terrorists, such as the Aryan Nation and eco-extremists. My job at the FBI was based on a simple concept to address a hugely complex challenge. The CIA and FBI exchanged senior officers to serve as deputies in their counterterrorism departments to boost understanding and cooperation between the two entities and advance the overall U.S. government counterterrorism mission. There were other cross-agency assignments also, at operational and technical levels. The inside joke in both organizations framed it somewhat differently. It was an exchange of hostages. The first to serve in the senior-level swap, CIA officer Jeff O'Connell and FBI agent Dale Watson, pioneered the program 3 years earlier. Jeff now served as the CIA's chief of CTC and Dale as the FBI's assistant deputy director. They both provided robust political support for the exchange program because they understood the cross-fertilization value. They personally benefited with promotions that reflected positively on the exchange. CIA officers and FBI agents realized that such an interagency assignment could boost their careers. More important, the assignments opened up a new world of knowledge and experience. From my perspective, this constellation of FBI leaders was excellent. Director Louis Free strongly supported the program and my assignment. So did his deputy, Tom Pickard. I had worked a counterintelligence case years earlier with him. Watson, after his rotation at the CIA's CTC, was the most supportive of them all. He routinely helped roll over bureaucratic roadblocks. The new guy at FBI HQS was Mike Rawlins, the Chief of International Terrorism Operations Section. After a couple of decades in U.S. field offices, he was new to FBI headquarters. He was my boss. I was his deputy. Mike looked like an FBI executive. Average height, muscular, handsome with sharp features, perfect hair, tailored shirts, and cufflinks. A Catholic from a hard-working family in upstate New York, he earned a degree in mathematics, then joined the Bureau. Smart, with an excellent memory for details, and an ability to regurgitate facts on command, he had mastered public speaking. He enjoyed public outreach and loved being an FBI special agent. He had a deep passion to serve the nation. Mike treated me as a line deputy, not a liaison contact from the CIA. He and I explored our new assignments together. We learned to rely on each other and became fast friends. We remain close today, more than a decade later. I recognized and honored Mike's trust, and I followed his orders, even at the bureaucratic expense